Hey, we all know how tough it can be to find the time to sit down and make progress on a book you've been trying to read. Tell me about it. I've got two kids. But what if I told you it's possible to absorb 10 nonfiction books in just an afternoon? Well, that's exactly what today's sponsor, Blinkist.com/ROF, allows you to do. Blinkist is the only app that takes popular nonfiction books, distills them down into summaries that you can read or listen to in about 15 minutes. You'll still get the most important takeaways and the crucial information from each book, but it'll be so in a concise, efficient package that you can consume in one sitting or at the gym or on your way to work or in between podcasts. Now look, I know I want to make time for reading as many books as I can, but there's only so many hours in the week. So why not go ahead and get the most valuable insights from nonfiction books that you otherwise wouldn't have had time for? They have everything from politics, history, philosophy, to economics, business, psychology, and personal development. You can try Blinkist totally free and get access to their library of thousands of condensed nonfiction books by going to Blinkist.com/ROF. That's Blinkist, BLINKIST.com/ROF. Welcome to this week's episode of Ring of Fire Radio. This is the first episode of 2019. We're happy to be back from the holidays, ready to go for what we anticipate will be a crazy year. And on today's show, Sarah Cliff from Vox asked readers to submit their emergency room bills. We'll ask her what she discovered. Legal expert Scott Lemieux will join us to discuss a couple of gerrymandering cases headed to the Supreme Court. Back to join me in 2019, Heather Digby Parton from Salon will help me analyze all the news that made headlines this week. And Eric Levitz from The Intelligencer in New York Magazine will tell us why Fox's Tucker Carlson plays a critic of capitalism on TV. Hey, folks, it's so important that you sign up for the Ring of Fire Radio podcast by going to ROFpodcast.com this year. You can sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. But if you want the full show, commercial-free, you can become a member and help keep us on the air in 2019. That's the best way to support this show. That's ROFpodcast.com. Here to run down what has been an already hot start to 2019, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her from her blog, Hullabaloo, Digby. So first off, Heather, let me say Happy New Year. We were not around last week, so we're still catching up a little bit. But this week we are right back at it. Of course, the government is shut down, basically where we left it at the end of 2018. By now, let's see, we are just a day or two away from when government workers would otherwise be getting their checks, and they will not be getting those checks as of this time. And this is because Donald Trump wants $5.6 billion to build a wall or some type of edifice that is made out of steel as opposed to concrete, because apparently Democrats don't like concrete, even though concrete's cheaper, but steel is better, and it's going to be slatted and it's going to be beautiful. But nobody wants this for a myriad of reasons. And this week we saw Donald Trump address the country and really say nothing, and then watch Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer follow him, not saying too much more, frankly, but give me your sense of this fight.
Well, Happy New Year to you, too, first. And,
thank you.
You know, welcome to our new reality here with the Democrats in charge of the House and Trump, you know, having a shutdown, which I just want to mention going in. He has said from the time he took office that he thinks shutdowns work for him, that he thinks it's a politically excellent sort of strategy for him. I think he thinks he's such a dominant, you know, alpha male that he's just going to eventually wear down or roll over the opposition and he will get what he wants. I think that's a fallacy. I also think it's just simply something that he believes because he really has no clue and no understanding of deal, right? I mean, you know, whatever he thought was deal making never was and certainly isn't in the context of, you know, top, you know, very high, you know, stakes government negotiations. Anyway, I don't think Trump really
wants to be fair about the negotiations. Would you just add that his father is no longer with us, and so he can't come in and be the guarantor for any type of deal, which was the way that Donald Trump got his start. But go ahead.
Exactly. And then later he had some Russian helpers. They are around, but they can't really help him on this, right?
Gotta lay low right now. We'll talk about that more later in the program, but go ahead.
Right. Not a good time for them to really, you know, kind of stick their heads up. But in any case, you know, this he doesn't understand this. And I think ultimately what Trump wants, I think it's a mistake to think he wants the wall. What he wants is to make sure that Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh aren't mad at him. Because before this, you know, whole shutdown happened, Trump was giving every indication that he was willing to go along with Mitch McConnell's plan, which was to reopen the government, you know, for a year, and to simply do a continuing resolution into February on the DHS budget, which is the source of this particular argument. He was willing to do that, and, you know, he wanted to fight this out and whatever, and, you know, but he wasn't really going to go to the mat. It was pretty clear that this was going to be something else. It would probably be kicked down the road. Rush Limbaugh and Ann Coulter had a fit, and I'm using them as sort of symbols, but they were specifically did have a fit, but there were plenty of others in their corner. And he got scared, and he even called up Rush Limbaugh and said, "Hey, you know, don't worry, you know, I'm gonna do it." And he backed off. And this is the same thing that happened the last time they tried to do this deal, when he and Pelosi and Schumer got together, with Lindsey Graham and a whole bunch of Republicans, and they put together a deal at that time for $25 billion for the wall, in exchange for the legalization of the DACA kids. And he backed off on that one as well when the right wing, I think in this case led by Steve Miller and some of the Freedom Caucus guys in the House came up to the White House and said, "What are you doing?" He backed off on that. So, you know, it's not every indication is to me that the wall itself is you know, something that's become a symbol to him, or as Lindsey Graham put it, is a metaphor for him, you know, giving
something.
Followers what they demand. You know, that he's there to deliver on this big campaign promise. Which, by the way, we should mention, was revealed to have been sort of a what do they call it?
I mean, mnemonic device.
It was a mnemonic device put together by Sam Nunberg, that crazy guy, and the other crazy guy, Roger Stone, when Trump first started running, in order that he wouldn't forget to talk about immigration, which was a subject he really had very little, you know, association with up to that point. I mean, he always cared about foreigners, but it was a trade thing. It didn't have to do with this specific thing. But Sam Nunberg and Roger Stone knew that this was sort of, you know, this was a hard right obsession, and they gave it to Trump to use, and of course he did to great effect. But the wall then became a big crowd pleaser, and he could say, you know, "Hey, you know, what about the wall? Yeah, you know," and they'd scream, "Who's going to pay for it? Mexico." And that became a thing for him, not because of any real, you know, genuine commitment. Well, look, we're talking about Trump. He doesn't understand anything. But it was never something that he specifically, you know, had sort of studied up on or been convinced was a great way to deal with the immigration issue or anything. It was just the kind of a campaign slogan that they used. So here we are now with the government shutdown in what is about to become the longest government shutdown in American history. And things are really starting to fall apart. And Trump is now, you know, I think that the speech he gave this week was less to try and convince his people. He told the reporters, he had some reporters up to the White House I guess they were network anchors or whatever, to talk about it off the record. And apparently what he told them was that he didn't think this was really going to work either, and he thought the border, visiting the border wall was kind of a stupid thing, but that his communications people had convinced him to do it. And I think they actually he was actually convinced to do it because they've got wavering Republicans for the first time in his administration. Republicans are starting to go, whoa. And that's because this thing is dragging on so long with no real way out.
We should be explicit about where that weakness is coming from in terms of the Republicans, right? Like, farmers are not getting loans. They're not going to be getting their payments from slush funds for to make up for the tariffs. So you've got, like, Kansas and Iowa, people like Joni Ernst, and in Colorado, you got Cory Gardner. You got Susan Collins, of course, who doesn't want to be in this situation. Shelley Capito in West Virginia, because people are starting to look... It's starting to look at their food stamps is going to be a problem. All right, well, let's take a break, because I want to add one more player into the mix whose name has not come up, but only in passing, and who, to me, seems to be the linchpin of this and has been virtually out of the news for the entire week, and that's Mitch McConnell. And Mitch McConnell is a player in this, although he seems to basically, his play seems to be duck and cover. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Digby. We're talking about the shutdown. And, of course, we will necessarily have to talk about the question of immigration as well. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back. Happy New Year, folks. You're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast, and you should hear what you're missing. You're only getting one third of the content we do every week. And when you become a member, not only will you get that extra content, you'll also get complete access to our archives of literally a decade of interviews. On top of that, you get everything commercial free. And most importantly, you make it possible for this show to continue. So why not become a member? It costs a couple of bucks a week. Check it out. You will not be disappointed. ROFpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, you, in the last segment, deftly walked us through this government shutdown, which is by now the longest one that we have seen in the history of our government. And it is we are on the brink of it becoming a serious, serious problem for more than just the people who have not gotten a paycheck. Of course, things like big infrastructure programs are put on complete hold because nobody can predict when they're going to get payments. You can't run businesses that way. We are in jeopardy of seeing a lack of funding for things like SNAP. We're looking at housing reimbursements for landlords, for people under Section 8. This is going to be problematic very shortly. So the pressure is mounting. And the interesting thing to me is we have a we have now four or five Republican senators who are saying, hey, let's just, you know, can't we figure out some way of punting this? Can't we put the wall stuff to the side? But Mitch McConnell has, to up to this point, not brought a bill to the floor, and he says he won't. And he's trying all sorts of things. They're bringing up, like, a bill to penalize any type of entities that are involved in the BDS boycott movement, which is just an absurd and maybe unconstitutional as far as I can tell. But the interesting player in this is Mitch McConnell, and yet we don't hear much about him in the media because people forget that the same people who were excoriating Donald Trump for potentially sort of sidelining the wall, whatever that means, are the same people who are also demonizing Mitch McConnell in the summer of 2016. I mean, Mitch McConnell is one of the most ostensibly hated figures in the Republican Party at that time. And as far as I know, Mitch McConnell is going to be up for re-election in 2020. And I think he is afraid of getting blamed for a Republican cave on this, because certainly Donald Trump will blame him, right? And this dynamic seems to me to be the most unreported dynamic that's out there right now.
Well, it does. I mean, let's look at Paul Ryan, just, you know, retired from the Congress and as Speaker. He had a 12% approval rating. Republicans hated him. I mean, you know, there was a time when Trump would show up back in the 2016 election, when Trump showed up and Paul Ryan didn't show up with him, and he was the, you know, they booed Paul Ryan in his own district. Same thing as you mentioned with Mitch McConnell. You're absolutely right that this dynamic is underreported in the press. And, you know, you have to look back. Look what happened to John Boehner. I mean, he was chased out of his job because of this dynamic as well, because he was trying to make deals. And that was also to keep the government open, by the way. Boehner retired because they were demanding that he do a shutdown, and he ended up making a deal that he would quit and that they would fund the government. He walked out with 2 years of government funding. He was actually able to do that. And that we settled this down a little bit during that period of the election and then a little bit beyond. McConnell also tried to do sort of something. I mean, before, as I mentioned in the earlier segment, that, you know, before the break at Christmas, he had put, you know, in the lame duck, he had put together a decent plan, which was simply, look, we're not going to do a government shutdown. Let's let this go for a year, except for DHS, and we'll argue over that. And I think he really felt, and I think maybe wisely so, that he had an upper hand in there, because what would then be happening is it would be Border Patrol, it would be uniformed men, you know, down at the border who weren't being paid and they're keeping us safe and all this. They would have had a stronger argument if it was just that on the line, right? I mean, hopefully the Democrats wouldn't have caved on it, but, you know, I think it would have been a stronger argument for them. And Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh pitched a fit. Trump backed out of the deal. I mean, it was pretty clear that he had signed on. So that is the dynamic that's happening here. These people have all of them, you know, absolutely, you know, by the neck on this, and it's very, very difficult for Republicans to do anything different. Now, let's not forget that there's a new option on the table, and that is this option of Donald Trump calling a national security emergency crisis and declaring that he is going to have the military, he's going to use military money and deploy military troops to the border to build his wall and take it completely out of the congressional, you know, process there. Now, you know, he's done this before. He did it with his trade war. He did it with the aluminum and steel tariffs. He declared a national security emergency on trade, and there is some obscure, you know, trade regulations that allowed him to do that, even though it's clear there was no national security emergency. I guess there was no fail-safe to, you know, stop him. So he did it. He's shown an inclination to do these things if he wants to. He already deployed the military to the border before Christmas, and they're still there, and they're going to put some more wire up, and beautiful barbed wire, as he calls it. So I would not be surprised at all if this is where they end up. I think, in my view, it's the only way that Trump can actually get himself out of this, and I think in some ways he assumes that this will make him look good with his base, which it probably will. It makes him a big macho dude who's, you know, basically, you know, autocratically, you know, using the military for his own political purposes. They like that sort of thing. And it would get Mitch McConnell off the hook.
Now, all right, Digby, if you'll join me in the next hour, I still have a lot of questions to ask you about this, because I'm not quite clear why Donald Trump didn't do that already this week.
Too.
And if that didn't make it harder, we're going to have to save that question and that answer for the next hour. But we have more to talk about. And I also want to talk about the question that no one seems to be asking in the Democratic Party. What is the Democratic Party's position on immigration?
Yep.
It was very hard to tell after the so-called rebuttal by Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer following Donald Trump. But we will talk about that in the next hour. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back, and Digby will join me in the second hour of the program. Coming up, Sarah Cliff from Vox went through thousands of emergency room bills. She's going to tell us what she found. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
Hey, folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Pap has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Our next guest spent a great part of 2018 going through emergency room bills submitted by readers of Vox to find out just how unpredictable ER bills can be across the country. Here to tell us what she found, Sarah Cliff. So, Sarah, let's start with the really massive project you undertook, I guess, about a little bit over a year ago. What was that project?
Yes, about a year ago, I started asking Vox readers to send me their emergency room bills, mostly because those prices that are charged at emergency rooms or charged anywhere in our healthcare system are kept secret, and I wanted to, you know, write about them. And so far, I've collected about 2,000 bills. I've read about 1,300 of them at this point. So, yeah, I've spent a lot of the past year collecting and reading a lot of stories from the emergency room.
That sounds like a total nightmare. But I'm fascinated by this because I had an emergency room visit, maybe I guess it was about a year and a half ago, and the whole billing process was bizarre. Nothing was serious on my part at all, so I'm perfectly healthy. So I found this fascinating. But before we go into the specifics of an emergency room, like, what is this opaque quality to billing? Is it different for the emergency room than it is for sort of, I guess, the hospital's general services? Like, what is going on with this dynamic where, you know, it's like, I'm going to order off the menu, but we can't tell you how much it's going to cost until after you finish your meal?
Yeah, you know, I think part of it is symptomatic of the larger system, but then there are some things that are unique about the ER space. I think what's symptomatic of the system is the fact that it's impossible to know the prices of healthcare before you go. And, you know, if you think of any other goods you shop for, you know, if you were going to the mechanic to fix your car, if you're going to a restaurant, you would want to know the prices of, you know, the repairs on your car, but you can't know the prices on the repairs you're getting done for yourself. So I think that is a general feature of the American healthcare system that is quite bad for patients. I think what's unique about the emergency room is twofold. One is that people are going there often not by their own choice. They're transported by ambulance. They're dealing with some kind of emergency. Often I read bills from people who didn't have an emergency, but it was a holiday. It was the weekend. It was after work, and the ER was the only place open. So I think that's one of the dynamics that's, you know, specific to the ER, is that people are often not making a choice. It's just the place they end up. And I think what's different is you have all these sort of providers in the ER, and this is something I've written about a lot, who might not be in network with, even though you're at an in-network hospital. So it's one of the places, you know, one study has found that one in five ER visits results in a surprise bill from a doctor who was working at an in-network ER but wasn't in network with insurance. So there are certain things that happen, you know, specifically in the ER, and some that are more symptomatic of our larger problems.
Well, let's start with that larger problem, and then we'll work our way down to that. I mean, I know there's been, there's obviously been people who have explored this, but why? I still can't quite understand why the pricing is so opaque. Like, how did it develop in that way? How did someone say, like, oh, I know what we'll do. Let's just make up, it feels like it's random prices, you know, and see what sticks, and not tell any of the buyers, because we don't want the idea that maybe somebody else paid half for this same procedure to inhibit the next person from paying double.
Yeah, it is a pretty Rube Goldberg-esque system that I don't think any healthcare wonk would have devised. I think, you know, when I look at the source of this, I think it's something that's different about us from most developed countries. In, you know, nearly every other developed country, and not just European countries, not just, you know, ones with larger welfare states, but places like Singapore or Hong Kong, also Canada, Britain, European countries, they have a government entity that regulates healthcare prices. And they do this because they see healthcare as just as important as electricity or gas. It's something you need to survive, and therefore the government is going to step in and, you know, set prices, because patients can't really, when it's your life at stake, you really don't have much negotiating power. The United States has made the decision not to have that kind of price regulation. That essentially leaves health insurers and hospitals to negotiate, you know, what they think is a fair price for everything from an appendectomy to a primary care visit to an ER trip. And no one in that system really has an interest in making things more transparent. You know, like you mentioned, Sam, a lot of people are quite proprietary, you know, particularly the hospitals and the insurers. They don't want their competitors to know what rate they got, and they want to keep that information secret. And unfortunately, there's really isn't any forcing mechanism to make that public. You know, that's why I started this whole project. The only way to find out, you know, what is actually being paid at emergency rooms is to look at the bills that patients have received. That's really the only way I could think of to do this. I wish there were an easier one, because reading ER bills all day is not the easiest way to do this. But that's unfortunately the best that we have right now.
Well, I mean, there is maybe an easier one. You had touched on it in terms of government regulation, but let's put a pin in that for a minute. But what is it about? What is it about this? Is it just simply, I mean, you know, in terms of emergency rooms, like, this is not a planned purchase, right? I mean, this is, it's extremely spontaneous. But what is it? Is it just that makes it? I mean, is there a market failure, or maybe just an inability for a market to deal with this type of service? Because we don't have this problem with, you know, cleaners. You know, with, you know, dry cleaners, or with, I don't know, hotels, or, you know, there's no other service that seems analogous to hospitals when it comes to pricing.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And, you know, I think what's different about it is this is healthcare is the only service you would purchase while unconscious. You know, I wrote a story yesterday that involved a patient who was having a blinding migraine. You know, she literally could not see. She managed to tap in 911 on her phone, was taken to a hospital that turned out to be out of network. And one of the things she said to me, which, you know, made me laugh a little bit, but it's also just terrible, was saying, you know, I don't think I could have avoided this. I literally could not see when I was, you know, when this decision was being made about where I was going to go. So I think that's, you know, one of the things that's different about the healthcare system, certainly different about the emergency room, is patients often aren't making the choice to go there. They don't have much choice. So you see some behavior similar to what a monopoly might do when they don't have competition. You know, you end up with these really high prices.
And even when it's not an emergency, the dynamic of competition doesn't kick in the same way, because we don't treat healthcare like we treat other commodities, at least as a, you know, we don't perceive ourselves as consumers as much as we can perceive ourselves as patients.
Yeah. And I think when you're thinking as a patient, you know, your hope is to get the best care possible, to get better, especially in emergency situations. You know, I think it's very challenging to, and I think another factor layered on top of this is most of the people you interact with in a hospital and an emergency room, they won't even be able to tell you what it's going to cost. If you, you know, if you ask your provider, you know, how much is that ultrasound, how much is that CAT scan, they probably won't know the answer, and they probably will not tell you the answer because that's just not something that they deal with. So, you know, I think a lot of times I get questions after doing this project about, well, how can I avoid a surprise ER bill? And unfortunately, there aren't great ways to do it. And I feel like it's a really unfair burden to put on patients, you know, that, you know, along with trying to get treatment, you're also trying to navigate the system in a system where you have very little power to say no or go somewhere else.
All right. Well, let's take a break and let's start. Let's talk about some of the highlights, the lowlights of what you've found about this experience. Some of this, like I say, not terribly surprising to me, as I experienced something like this, and it was pretty shocking. But we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Sarah Cliff just after this.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours pouring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with Sarah Cliff from Vox about her piece. I read 1,182 emergency room bills this year. Here's what I learned. So, Sarah, when we broke, you were telling us about this project that you embarked on a year ago. I think you probably deserve a medal for something like this, where you have looked through approximately 1,500 of 2,000 emergency room bills that you solicited from your readers at Vox as part of a project to bring some type of transparency to the billing procedures in emergency rooms, which is not terribly different from the billing procedures. And I guess I want to call it a system, but it's not really a system in hospitals. The first thing that you found, or one of them, I should say, is that prices are high, and it's amazing. They're super, super high, aren't they?
Yeah, and I feel like this was actually driven home for me by just looking at the prices of things, you know, I've purchased in the past at a drugstore and how much those cost in an emergency room. And, you know, one great example of that is a pregnancy test, which, you know, usually you can buy from a drugstore for $5 to $10 or even cheaper. In emergency rooms, I saw at least a half dozen bills where pregnancy tests cost more than $100. I saw one that stood out to me where a single pregnancy test was billed at $400. So I think the thing, you know, it is both the prices are high and they vary very hugely from one hospital to another.
Well, my question is, like, how do they judge? Like, I can understand it if you say, like, look, you show up at the ER, you cross the threshold, and we're going to charge you $1,700. That's just what it is. It's enormous, but, you know, we're not going to lie about the cost of the eye drops or the ibuprofen. Why do they do it this way?
I think because they can.
Like, but is there any internal rationale, or they literally just go like, okay, I got a pair of die. I'm going to roll them. And if it's a 2-6, that's how much an Advil costs, $26. I mean, like, how do they even come up with the numbers?
So from what I understand, and actually, you know, an article that some listeners might be familiar with is Steve Brill's Bitter Pill, which was a massive story for Time, where he gets into this a lot. One of the things I've seen in my reporting, one of the things he writes about there, is a lot of hospitals have something called a charge master, which is basically their master list of all the charges for different healthcare items at their hospital. That charge master might have been created decades ago. And then year after year, it's just updated. So, you know, they say, okay, there's an inflation, there's an this and that, we're going to update the charge master by 3% or 5%. And then when they're working with insurance companies, they're negotiating discounts off of that charge master. So you often have this kind of legacy document that might have lost all sort of, it might have lost any relation to the actual price of healthcare that just keeps getting updated year after year. And because this is also opaque, it's kind of hard for patients to see what's going on or, you know, make the decision like, I want to go to the hospital with $30 pregnancy tests instead of $400 pregnancy tests.
Right. Okay. And so the next thing you found is that even if you go to an in-network hospital, it doesn't mean that you're going to be seen by an in-network doctor. How does that work?
Yeah. So that's one of the things you actually see pretty commonly. The best research we have suggests that 1 in 5 ER visits, there is a patient at an in-network hospital who's seen by an out-of-network provider. And the way that works is that many hospitals have people who don't accept insurance, doctors, surgeons, radiologists, working and staffing those hospital units. So, you know, I wrote about a patient out in Texas who was attacked pretty violently in the middle of the night, was left unconscious, and a bystander called an ambulance who brought him to the ER. When he woke up in the ER, he actually pulled out his phone to check if this hospital's in network, which is a uniquely American thing to do. And he finds out, great, it's in network, I'm fine. Turns out he needs emergency jaw surgery, and that jaw surgeon is not in network. And so he ended up with an $8,000 bill from his jaw surgery. Unless states have some kind of legislation, you know, outlawing that kind of behavior, you know, legislation that says, if you're going to be at a hospital, you have to be in network with the same health insurance plans. That kind of billing behavior is perfectly legal and pretty common.
Okay. And another point you make that you found is that you can be charged for just sitting in a waiting room. And I experienced this having gone to an emergency room. I had, one point I thought I was having a heart attack. I mean, long story. I clearly wasn't. But I went in there. I sat into the emergency room. I got charged, I don't know, something like $1,500 to get an EKG. And then I got a notice from a collection agency like a year later that I had owed for another $500. And I said, that's not possible. I paid the $1,700. And it turned out that was for the doctors that were there.
Yeah.
And I was like, I called up the emergency room. I said, well, what if I just came into the waiting room? And they're like, well, no, you would have been charged. And that's crazy.
It's, yeah, and I mean, the story I wrote about that, the amounts are even higher. I wrote about a woman who was seen at an emergency room in Hoboken, New Jersey, who she had cut her ear. She had fallen, had blood coming out of her ear, went to the emergency room, but found out that the doctors were out of network and decided, okay, I'm going to go be seen somewhere else. They did give her an ice pack for her ear, and for, you know, that experience of finding out the doctor's out of network and getting an ice pack, she ended up with a bill for just over $5,700.
Wow.
You know, they did end up dropping that bill after I wrote about it. But before I got involved, you know, they were really sticking with it, saying, you know, this is the price of seeking care in our emergency room. And, you know, she was someone who had a significant deductible on her plan, and they were saying she was responsible for that.
All right. So let's just step back. Big picture. You mentioned that most countries, maybe all countries, on some level, their government regulates the prices. Right now, obviously, something like Medicare for All is big in the news. When we talk about a Medicare for All, does that involve explicit price regulation, or is it just simply in terms of like, well, we're going to be the insurance provider, and we're just not going to pay more for a certain treatment?
So it really does involve explicit price regulation. I think that's one of the things when you look at what about a Medicare for All system saves money. Part of it is the efficiency. You just have one big health insurance plan. But I think the real way to save money in a system like that is that the government is setting the prices. And, you know, when the government is the only game in town offering insurance, hospitals all of a sudden have a whole lot less leverage in asking for high prices because all their business is flowing through this one government entity. So, you know, if you look at a place like Britain, you can look up the prices of all the things that healthcare systems provide. And, you know, that is a feature right now of Medicare, which covers Americans over 65 and is essentially a single payer system for that population. So yes, it is definitely a feature of any sort of Medicare for All plan.
Where does the delta between what a price-controlled system would look like and a non-price-controlled system, where does that extra money end up?
You know, some of it ends up with hospitals, you know, who there are many for-profit hospitals in our country. Some ends up with insurers. You know, some of it ends up as medical debt that goes unpaid from folks who can't afford their bills. So, you know, and some of that is going into the salaries of healthcare providers. One of the things that's a little bit unique about the U.S. is that our providers are paid significantly more than doctors abroad. And there is a big, long discussion about the price of graduate education and what drives that. But all that money is basically going to all the different actors in our healthcare system.
Well, Sarah, maybe we will have that conversation a little bit more in depth in the coming months, maybe years. But thank you so much for your time today. Fascinating stuff. And like I say, I think you deserve a medal.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Sarah Cliff is a senior policy correspondent at Vox.com, where she focuses on the Republicans' effort to repeal Obamacare and what that'll mean for millions of Americans who rely on the law for coverage. Vox, she hosts The Impact, a podcast about how policy affects real people. She's also co-host of The Weeds, a podcast with Ezra Klein and Matt Iglesias. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will rejoin us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, ROFpodcast.com to hear what you've been missing.